Okay, so here we are. This is the second lecture in Chapter 8. Chapter 8 is on inflation. And I've got a couple of videos for you today. They're both on inflation. One is very short, so let's just watch the videos and then we'll talk about them. So what causes inflation?
Before we do this, we must first define the term. So what is inflation? Inflation is usually seen as a general rise in the level of prices, measured by the CPI, our Consumer Price Index. We've experienced this when we go to the gas station and see the price of fuel going up. We've seen our house inflate in value, and at the grocery store, food gets more and more expensive. However, this rise in prices is not the inflation itself, but rather a symptom of inflation. Inflation is actually defined by an increase in the money supply. Now that we've defined the term, what causes this increase in the money supply? To do this, we need to look at a nation's central bank. In the United States, it's known as the Federal Reserve. They're the ones with the power to increase the money supply, and therefore responsible for inflation. The Federal Reserve, often referred to as just the Fed, has several means to do this by. One of the main ways it does this is by lowering the interest rate. So how do interest rates work? It's a simple case of supply and demand. The supply is savings, and the demand is people, businesses, or governments wanting loans. If people decide to save up a lot of their money, banks are willing to lend at low interest rates. If there is a low level of savings, it's going to cost more in the form of high interest rates. This is where the Fed comes in. They have the power to artificially lower the interest rate. In order to fill the demand for these low interest rate loans, the supply of savings needs to increase. This increase in the supply of savings is all newly created money, all of which increases the money supply, and that is what causes inflation.
Well, that was pretty simple there.
What causes inflation?
Let me get rid of this. Before we do this,
we must first define the term.
So, that was very short. Now, what really causes inflation? And this is what really causes inflation. Now, this is something that we looked at last time. Let's see, from current slide. What really causes inflation is this right here. This is one of the most important equations of the semester, but MV equals PQ. Now, people say that, well, when we increase the money supply, that causes inflation, but really what causes inflation is that when the money supply increases more than goods and services, taking into consideration velocity, and of course Q is there. Q is the goods and services. So M, of course, is money. Velocity is how quickly a dollar changes hands. Right? We talked about this last time. What happens to the velocity of money during boom times? It speeds up, right? During depressions, it slows down. That's velocity. How quickly a dollar changes hands is what is called velocity. So P, of course, is the general price level overall, and Q is quantity or gross domestic product. So when we work out some math, divide both sides by Q, what really causes inflation is the money supply times velocity divided by Q equals the general price level. So there's actually three factors that cause inflation. Now, how can the money supply increase? Well, who's the only one that can increase the money supply? The Federal Reserve, correct? And the Federal Reserve creates money when it practices quantitative easing. Now, there's an important term that you want to never forget. Quantitative easing, as you should know by now, is when the Fed Reserve creates money to buy something. Usually it's bonds, mostly from the United States government. U.S. government borrows money by selling bonds. When it sells bonds to the Federal Reserve, and when the Federal Reserve creates new money to buy those bonds, that's what's called quantitative easing. And now we have an increase in the money supply. Now, does that necessarily cause inflation in America? Yes or no? Not necessarily. Why?
Because the money is spread out.
Yeah, in other words, you've got to look at, if you're looking at the American dollar, you've got to look at the United States as a sphere, as part of the world. Now, when the money supply increases in that sphere, you see, when the money supply increases more than goods and services increase, taking into consideration velocity, then we get inflation. But the Federal Reserve can practice quantitative easing, but if a lot of that money doesn't get into our system, then the money supply has not really increased. And we're, with all the quantitative easing we've had over in the trillions of dollars over the past several years, where has a lot of the money gone to? Well, it's not gone into a system, into the pockets of the average person. It's gone into the international community. A big part of it's gone into the derivatives market, but a lot of it has simply also gone into foreign nations for other reasons than the derivatives market. And remember, the derivatives market is over a $600 trillion market worldwide. And who participates in the derivatives market? I mean, do you and I participate in the derivatives market? No, it's for institutions or high rollers in terms of wealthy people. It's almost like a parallel universe. You know, we live in this universe, and then there's another universe out there that people are engaged in, and they buy and sell, and they make bets on some future events. And it's just like it's a parallel universe, but they are connected, because you see, one of the problems with the derivatives market and other related markets is so much of it is based on leverage. Now, what does that mean? I say that most of this derivatives market is based on leverage. What does that mean? Anybody?
Well, I mean, leverage is like, it means like the company is like owned by the banks, essentially.
Leverage simply means borrowed money.
Yeah.
See, when you buy something with borrowed money, you're using leverage. And so a lot of this market that this money is going into, this newly created money, a lot of the activity there is fueled by a lot of leverage. In other words, people are making bets on the outcome of some future event, but they're not using existing money. They're borrowing money to make these bets. And that is how these two parallel universes are connected. All right, you see, okay, we got quantitative easing. A lot of the money is going, into foreign countries. It's going off into the derivatives market, and a lot of the activity in the derivatives market is based on leverage. So when does that universe affect our universe? Well, when things start to head south, and a lot of those people have to sell their assets in order to make, see, they borrowed money. Okay, now let's say they lose the bet. So they've got to get the money from somewhere. But because things have headed south, maybe money has disappeared from their bank accounts for different reasons. So what do they got to do? Well, they got to sell their assets. And that's when the two universes are connected. That's how, when things go awry in that parallel universe, when the economy heads south, it's going to affect our world. Does that make sense? So I'm painting to you a picture of, well, it's future events. When? No one really knows, but it is going to happen. Okay, so anyway, I've got another video for you. And it explains the consequences of inflation in Argentina. But this could be any country that experiences high rates of inflation. Okay, this is 8 minutes long. Let's see.
Florida Street in downtown Buenos Aires has long been a popular destination for people looking to buy football jerseys and cheap suitcases. Nowadays, it's also the place to buy American dollars, something Argentines are fond of because, unlike their own currency, the peso, dollars hold their value. Saving money has never been easy in Argentina. From 1944 to 2013, inflation in the country averaged 205%, hitting a whopping 20,000% in 1990, when the prices in supermarkets doubled every day. Now, inflation runs at about 30% and is expected to rise to 40% by the end of the year. To protect their wealth, Argentines have had to get creative. Those who can afford it buy real estate, and until recently, when a punishing tax was introduced, they also bought cars as a means of storing value. But for a long time, the most common savings maneuver in Argentina has been to buy dollars. Wary of their country's banking system, some Argentines stuffed those dollars in their mattresses and freezer boxes, while others simply sent them out of the country. This practice was personally helpful, but it also drained Argentina's foreign exchange reserves. In 2011, Argentines took $21.5 billion out of the country, or over one-third of reserves. To staunch this alarming flow of dollars out of the country, the government introduced a new system that required the tax agency's permission to buy foreign currency. Hopeful buyers were usually denied, while the Argentine government sold around $80 billion to savers between 2007 and 2011. After the new system was instituted, that number plunged to almost zero, inspiring Argentines to refer to it as the clamp. This crackdown led to the flourishing of an informal currency market called the blue market. The exchange rate is much pricier than the official exchange rate, sometimes by as much as 70%, but to many Argentines, it is worth it. Buying dollars, however expensive, affords them peace of mind and allows them to save to one day buy property or travel abroad. Smaller blue market exchange transactions often take place on Florida Street, where it is impossible to walk more than a few steps without a money changer trying to lure you in with the chant of cambio, cambio, cambio. The Argentine government recently relaxed the dollar clamp. Since the end of January, banks have been authorized to sell small amounts of dollars, but the paltry sums doled out have not been enough to sate the country's hunger for hard currency. The blue market will continue to play an important role, tempting Argentines who might otherwise abide by the law to engage in illicit exchanges.
Better get rid of this because you never know what comes up next, you know. Well, a couple things there. When a country does experience high rates of inflation like they have in Argentina, people want to preserve their wealth somehow. And of course, what's happened in Argentina is that people would take their currency and put it into US dollars. Now, if we have inflation here in America, people would do the same thing, although it wouldn't be the U.S. dollars, but it would have to be in something. Now, one thing that people do during high rates of inflation is that instead of keeping cash, they will buy assets that hopefully will retain its value. See, when we have inflation, things lose their value because it takes more dollars to buy those things. And so to retain value, people will buy things in kind. And that's just a little bit about the inflation. Now, who does inflation hurt, by the way? So that's another thing that the video pointed out. And from current slide, and we were on slide 30. Savers actually are hurt by inflation, and debtors are actually benefit from inflation. That's another thing about inflation, because if you owe somebody money, then if there's inflation, then what happens is that incomes go up along with inflation. But if the debt that you owe does not go up, then it's easier for you to pay off your debt. But who's really hurt by inflation are those people who have savings. If you put money in the bank, and let's say you don't earn any interest, but inflation is, let's say, 10%, then in that time period, your money has lost value by 10%. So savers are hurt by inflation, whereas debtors actually benefit from inflation. That's something else that that video pointed out. Okay, anyway, let's get back to these slides. We did leave off at slide 30 last time. Do government mandated price controls work? And the answer is no. They simply alter the economic system, for example, shortages in the former Soviet Union. The point here is that we cannot thwart the market, period. Even if you have a dictatorial government with all power, then the market is still going to have its way. And a good example of this is the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union no longer exists. It imploded. But when it did exist, there was the government had absolute power. The government decided, made decisions on what was going to be produced and what the prices of everything was going to be. There was a committee called Gosplan, where they decided what was going to be produced and the price of everything. See, they didn't allow the market to determine price. Now, what happened is that they put a very low price on food. Okay, and you might think, well, you know, that's a good thing. But what happened when you put a low price on something, there's a whole bunch of people that want it. Of course, the people who are supplying it have got less incentive to supply because they can't make as much money because of low prices. And so what happens is you have shortages. Now, what happened in the Soviet Union is that during those days, the average person spent several hours a day just standing in lines. In fact, families who had older people living with them were fortunate because older people had time to stand in lines. You stand in line to buy bread. You stand in line to buy milk. You stand in line to buy eggs. Everywhere you go, there were lines. Why? Because there were shortages of everything. Now, if you count the time standing in line as part of the price that you pay to buy something, let's say bread, then what happened in the Soviet Union is that the government dictated an artificially low price, a price below the market price. But every time it did that, the line simply got longer. So people actually paid the full price, but they didn't pay the full price in money. They paid a part of the price as time spent standing in lines. See, the point here is that even in a dictatorial government, you still can't thwart the market. The market's going to have its way. It may look different. See, prices were still low, but people spent so much time staying in line. So it looks different, but the price mechanism still worked. So that's why price controls don't work. Because you can't thwart the market, especially over the long run. And of course, this is the market. When I say the market, what do I mean by the market? Well, the market is always market demand, and market supply. So you've got a downward sloping demand curve, right? Because as the price goes down, the quantity demand, it goes up. People want to buy more at the low prices and vice versa. And the supply curve has a positive slope because if the price goes up, what happens to the incentive for the supplier to supply? It goes up, right? The supplier can make more money at the higher prices than at the lower prices. That's why supply curves have a positive slope. So where the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied is where the equilibrium price is at. But why is this an equilibrium price? Well, to know why, you have to move away from it. So if you move above where quantity demand is quantity supplied, you're eventually going to get a surplus. As price goes up, demanders say, well, we don't want to buy as much. But what does suppliers say? Well, we want to supply more. With more being supplied than being demanded, you got a surplus. And what happens then? Well, with the surplus, eventually prices come down. And then the prices fall below the equilibrium, and as prices keep going on down, see, what do suppliers say to themselves? Well, we don't want to supply as much. What do demanders say to themselves? Well, we want more at these low prices. So eventually you get shortages. And in a free market, how do we decide who gets? The highest bidder. Right, people bid against one another, and those who want it the most and those who have the money to pay for it get, and everyone else doesn't get. That's how markets work. So people bid the price up. And so this is why where the quantity demand goes quantity supplied is the equilibrium price, and we can call the equilibrium price the market price, although there is technically some difference. The equilibrium price is what happens instantaneously, but markets, there's always a lag effect for different reasons. So in essence, the market price is always chasing after the equilibrium price. But that's a little detail that really you don't have to necessarily know. Now, can businesses or consumers cause inflation? Well, no, of course not. Who's the only institution that can cause inflation? The Federal Reserve, period. Because the Federal Reserve is the only institution that has the authority to create money. Now, what would happen if tomorrow all business people woke up and they said, I feel a great urge to raise my price by 10%. So you might say, well, if all business owners raise the price by 10%, then we'd get inflation, right? But what would happen? If all prices went up 10%, what would people do? Well, people would start making priority purchases. They can't afford to buy as much at the higher prices as they did at the lower prices. So they might say, well, I'm still going to make my car payment. I'm still going to pay for my cell phone. I'm still going to but I'm not going to go out to eat as much. Or I'm not going to buy that new TV or that new computer that I want. I'll just do it with my old one. See, people start making priority purchases. And with a fall in demand for certain items, those prices start to go down. And that's why business owners or consumers cannot cause inflation, at least not over a period of time. Because if they cause higher prices, people can't buy as much of some things, those prices eventually start to go down. But how can we have inflation across the board? Well, the Fed Reserve can create money. So people have more money to buy things with in the marketplace. That's what causes inflation. And who's hurt by inflation? Well, those on a relatively fixed income. The more fixed your income is, then the more you're hurt by inflation. The more your income increases along with the inflation, then the less you're hurt by inflation. It's that simple. You know, low-income people in America are not hurt so much by inflation because all government programs have a cost of living clause attached to it, called a COLA, C-O-L-A, cost of living adjustment. And what happens is that the amount of money they receive increases periodically, usually annually, commensurate with the inflation rate. So if your income increases commensurate with the inflation rate, then you're not hurt by that inflation. Now, in terms of businesses, who is hurt by inflation? Well, not necessarily. You might say some small businesses, but what is the exact answer to that would be businesses that face a price elastic demand curve are hurt by inflation, and businesses that face a price inelastic demand curve are not hurt by inflation. And the elderly are hurt the most, and the young married couples are hurt the least. Well, this is a historical thing. It's not true all the time, but the reason I've got this here is that inflation is a very personal thing. That's really the point to this slide. You know, the inflation rate that I face may be different than the inflation rate that you face because I'm of a different generation, and the things that I normally buy may be going up in price, but the things that you would normally buy may be going down in price. So inflation, you see, is a very personal thing. I mean, we come up with an inflation rate for the whole economy, but in terms of individuals, all of us are faced with a different inflation rate, depending upon which prices are going up and how much and what our buying habits are. And lenders and borrowers, lenders are hurt more if the inflation is unanticipated. Now, here we have, it makes a difference if inflation is anticipated or not. When a lender lends money out, they always have to consider inflation. A lender might say, well, I'm going to lend money out, and I have to make at least a 10% real return in order to make this worth my while. Now, I'm going to lend money out, let's say, on an annual basis, and I figure that over the next year, inflation is going to be 3%. Well, if I want to make a 10% real return when I lend money out, what percent am I going to charge? 13%. If I charge 13% and inflation is, as I anticipated, 3% in that year, then I make a 10% real return, which is what I wanted. So I'm not hurt by inflation, and I don't benefit from inflation. And same with the borrower. The borrower might say, well, If I pay 13% interest, and if inflation's 3%, then the real interest rate I'm paying is 10%, and I'm satisfied with that. So both the borrower and lender in this example correctly anticipated the inflation rate, and both were satisfied. Neither one either won or lost. However, let's say the lender says, okay, I've got to make a 10% real return on my loan, my investment, and I anticipate inflation to be 3%. But instead of 3%, inflation's 13%. This is what happened during the 1970s. Well, now, if inflation's 13% and I lent money out and I charged and I charged 13% interest, how much have I made in real terms? Nothing, right? I mean, the person I lent money to pays me back exactly the same amount of money I lent him in real terms. So I'm hurt. See, but the borrower actually gains because the borrower is paying back the same amount of money they borrowed in real terms. See, that's what can happen when inflation is not anticipated correctly. Of course, it could be the opposite. If I say inflation is going to be 3% as a lender, and over that period inflation zero, then how much have I made in real terms? 13% instead of 10%. So I gain in this case, and the borrower loses because they paid 13% in real interest when they really only anticipated paying 10% in real interest. So you see, who gains and who loses with inflation depends on the anticipation. People have got to make decisions based on what they think is going to happen in the future. And if you anticipate incorrectly, then you could be hurt or you could actually gain. It depends on the situation. Borrowers are hurt more if inflation is anticipated. Okay. She told me she had to leave early, so I do appreciate that. I've got one other person that's going to leave early, right? And you got to leave? Okay. Well, thanks for letting me know. Yeah, I do appreciate that. Now, there are different types of inflation. Demand pull inflation is when demand increases more than goods and services increase. Okay, that's called demand pull inflation. An increase in demand pulls prices up. Okay, and will any increase in demand cause inflation? No. It depends on where your aggregate demand curve falls on the aggregate supply curve. And here we have a picture of the long-run aggregate supply curve. Now, we're down on the left here is zero, price is zero, quantity is zero. And so in this area here, we could say that the economy is in a depression. You know, Q was very low. Now, when is Q very low? When things are, when we've got boom times or when we're in a depression? Q, meaning gross domestic product, goods and services, right? There, you know, there's a big slope. When we're in a depression, things are very sluggish, right? So Q is very low. Now, here in this portion here, when you have a lot of unemployment, you have a lot of unused capacity. You've got a lot of factories that aren't being used. You've got a lot of unemployed people that don't have jobs during depressions, okay? So demand can increase, all right? But will this cause an increase in the price level? No, because what happens when demand increases is that we just use a factory that's been lying idle for several years and we put it back into production. We don't have to build a new factory. When demand increases, we can hire people, but we don't. Pay them more. I mean, they were unemployed, and so we don't. There's no reason, you know, for wages to increase because there's plenty of unemployed people still. And well, employers have their pick of whoever they want. All right. So when demand increases during depressions, there's no increase in the price level. But eventually, when demand increases, eventually here you see, we're going to run out of some of our resources. Could be labor. It could be our factories, or it could be any number of things. And those things that we run out of, well, now when demand increases, we don't have enough for everybody. And so what happens is the increase in demand tends to pull some prices up. Now, theoretically, if demand increases here at D5, the supply curve becomes vertical because theoretically we've run out of everything. Everybody who wants a job has a job. Every factory that we can use is already in production. And so demand can increase, but it takes time to train people, to bring people into the workforce. It takes time to build new factories. And so meanwhile, the increase in demand doesn't affect Q, but has total effect on the price level. So here's the question. Will an increase in aggregate demand cause inflation? And the answer is that all depends. What does it depend on? It depends on where the aggregate demand curve falls on the aggregate supply curve. If it falls on the horizontal portion of the aggregate supply curve, the answer is no. But if it falls on the upward sloping portion of your aggregate supply curve, then the answer is yes. Okay, so is it easy to fight demand pull inflation? Yes, because all we have to do is lower demand. Whatever we do to lower demand, I mean, if prices are high because of high demand, when we lower demand, well, prices will start to come down, period. But what about supply side inflation? What happens when inflation is caused by a shift to the left of your aggregate supply curve? Now, what can cause a shift to the left of the aggregate supply curve? Well, what can cause if you own a business and your costs went up. Now, remember, cost and price mean two different things in economics. Cost is a business term, price is a consumer term. So if you own a business and your costs go up, what happens to your ability to supply? It goes down, right? You can't supply as much when you're paying higher costs than you did when costs were a lot lower, right? So an increase in costs shift the aggregate supply curve to the left because suppliers can't afford to supply as much with the higher costs as they did with the lower costs. Okay? And that's what we call supply side inflation. When costs go up, aggregate supply curve shifts to the left, that increases the equilibrium price and eventually the market price, and now we get inflation. So basically, there's two types of inflation. There's demand pull, demand increases, pulling demand up, aggregate demand increases, pulling the price level up. Cost push inflation says that costs increase, which shifts the aggregate supply curve to the left, which causes inflation. Two types of inflation. And this is what is called cost push inflation, by the way. When the aggregate supply curve shifts to the left, the increase in costs push prices up. See, so we call that cost push inflation. Now, is it easy to fight cost push inflation? And the answer is no. Here's the problem. If we have cost push inflation, and if we take action with our monetary and fiscal policies to lower demand, aggregate demand, what effect will that have on the price level? And the answer is, well, not much right away. How come? Well, because prices weren't high because of high demand. They were high because of high costs. So you can lower the aggregate demand curve through your monetary and fiscal policies, but that's not going to have an immediate effect on the price level. Now, if you keep demand down low enough and long enough, then eventually prices will start to come down. So what is the difference? If you have demand pull inflation, you lower demand and boom, prices come down. If you have cost push inflation, you can lower demand, but you're going to have to keep demand suppressed for a long time before the price level starts to come down. So the difference is really time. Time. Demand pull inflation, lower demand, boom, price come down. Cost push inflation, you lower demand, well, you got to have some patience here. It's going to take a while. Now, if we have inflation, is it a matter of, oh, well, all prices are high because of the demand forces, or all prices are high because of supply forces? Well, no, you can have the same types, these two types of inflation at the same time. If we have an inflation problem, some prices may be high because of high demand, but other prices may be high because of high costs. Now, how bad was the inflation rate of the 1970s? Inflation averaged 10% a year during the 1970s. Now, if we have inflation 10% annually, how long would it take the prices to double? And if you use the rule of 72, okay, 10 goes into 72 about 7 times, so that tells us that it'll take about 7 years for prices to double with a 10% annual inflation rate year after year. And that's what happened during the 1970s. Prices, we had about a 10% increase in prices for most of the decade, annually, 10% this year, 10% next year, 10% the following year. Now, how many people's incomes do you think increased 10% annually during the 70s? Not too many.
Isn't it because we switched, we like stopped doing the gold standard or backing our money behind gold?
No, there are reasons. I'm going to go into the reasons why we had inflation in the 70s, but that wasn't one of them. Of course, ultimately, I mean, there can be causes of inflation that might cause temporary short-term inflation, but, you know, keep your mind on the fact that in order to have long-term, deep-rooted inflation, the money supply has got to increase more than goods and services increase. Also, taking into consideration velocity. Okay, remember that there are three factors that actually cause inflation: the money supply, GDP, and the velocity of money. All three of those affect the price level. And what caused inflation in the 70s? Well, in the early 70s, OPEC, now OPEC stands for the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, of which most of the countries that export oil are members of OPEC. It's a cartel, and they collude. They used to anyway. This collusion has fallen down here in the past year or so, but for many years, you know, they acted as if they were a monopoly, because they would all work in unison. They would all agree on their price level, and so OPEC greatly increased the price of oil in the early 70s. And oil is so fundamental to our way of life that when the price of oil goes up, eventually the price of almost everything goes up. You know, transportation, everything that oil is made from, petroleum products, I mean, there's medicines, I mean, the list goes on and on. So if we have a big increase in the price of oil, then we get inflation. When the price of oil goes down, the opposite's true, and that's what's happening now. The price of oil has gone down, and this has caused lower costs instead of higher costs. Union bargain for higher wages greater than an increase in productivity. Now, here is something, you know, are unions good or bad? Now, I ask you a question. Are unions good or bad? And what should come out of your mouth?
Yes.
No, what should come out of your mouth is, well, that all depends, right? It all depends. You know, usually when, you know, when you're asked a question in economics, you begin your answer by saying, well, that all depends, right? So are unions good or bad? Well, that all depends. What does it depend on? If unions bargain for pay raises greater than their increase in productivity, then what happens to the cost of doing business? It goes up. And we get cost push inflation. All right? But if a worker's increased productivity by, let's say, 10%, and let's say that a worker's payroll is 100% of the cost of a business, just for simplification purposes. So if worker's productivity increases 10%, and we're going to assume that business costs go down by 10%, can the business increase the worker's wages by 10% and not experience any increase in costs? Yeah, see, their costs go down 10% on one hand because productivity has increased 10%, and so they pay their workers 10% increase in wages. Well, what's happened to their costs overall? Well, their costs stay the same. So is there any need for that business to raise prices because of cost push inflation? No. Okay. Now, if workers bargain for, let's say, a 15% increase in pay, and productivity is only, let's say, 5%, then what happens to cost for business? It's gone up by 10%. Again, you know, assuming in this example that cost is 100% of the expense of a business, just to keep, you know, this example clear. So in that case, business experience an increase in costs. So what does business have to do to make up for the increase in cost? They have to raise the prices. Now, which businesses can get away with it and experience an increase in total revenue despite the increase in prices? Those that face a price inelastic demand curve. Businesses that face a price elastic demand curve, when they raise prices, their total revenue goes down. See? Again, it all depends. I mean, okay, unions bargain for pay raises greater than the increase in productivity. That leads to an increase in costs to the business. The businesses, let's say, have to raise their prices. Which businesses are hurt and which businesses are not hurt? Businesses that face a price inelastic demand curve are not hurt. Businesses that face a price elastic demand curve are hurt. See how you can see, and if you understand how to work economics, you can answer questions very definitively. It's you know, it's not an opinion, it's just mathematics. It's like with the minimum wage law. I mean, is the minimum wage law good or bad?
It all depends.
That all depends, right? And what does it depend on? It depends on whether the increase in the minimum wage law is greater than or less than the equilibrium wage. In other words, costs. In other words, if we impose a minimum wage and that minimum wage is greater than the equilibrium wage, what has got to result? Unemployment and slower growth. I mean, it's the only physical thing that could possibly happen. But if the minimum wage only brings up the wage, you know, up to, let's say, the equilibrium wage, then the increase in the minimum wage won't cause any unemployment. In fact, it may be then good for the economy. But what's one of the bad things about a federally imposed minimum wage law? Because the equilibrium wage is different depending upon where you're at. I mean, It differs from city to city. It differs from city to country. It differs from season to season. It differs from big business and little business. I mean, see, as a group, who's in favor of a higher minimum wage law? Big business. Big business, because they can afford to pay the higher wages and drive their smaller competitors out of business. See, big business loves high minimum wage laws. That just means less competition for them and more profits. Okay? I mean, see, this is just mathematics. This is not an opinion. It's just sheer mathematics. If you understand how the world works. See, what is creeping inflation? Well, it's a slow but steady rate of inflation, and there's nothing wrong with creeping inflation. You know, if especially if it's anticipated. If we have a 3% inflation rate year after year, and that's totally anticipated, and people make decisions based on that anticipation, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's not going to cause any more trouble than no inflation. But when can inflation be harmful? Well, when inflation can be harmful when it's unanticipated, especially if it's high rather than low. But the worst thing is erratic inflation. You know, 5% this year, 10% the next year, 2% the next year, 25% the next year. I mean, people don't know what to expect. They don't know if it's going to be high or low, and this causes confusion. See, we all make decisions based on what we think is going to happen in the future, right? I mean, you know, why are you in this classroom? Why are you in college? Not because of the here and now necessarily, but because of what you think is going to happen to you in the future, correct? You make your decisions based on what you think is going to happen in the future. Well, if inflation is erratic and people don't know what to expect in the future, they become, they're unwilling to take risks. They become very conservative. They're unwilling to venture out because, well, they don't know what to expect. And this is what slows down economic growth. It actually could cause a shrinkage in the economy. With, you know, people, you know, the economy is made up of people. It's not buildings and machines and tools, it's people. We're the economy. And if we, as a group, become more cautious and aren't willing to take risks, see, nothing is gained unless a risk is taken. Is there any guarantee that all the money that you're paying for your college is ever going to pay off for you? No, there's no guarantees, correct? So are you taking a risk by being here? Would you be taking a risk if you weren't here and you were flipping burgers from McDonald's? You see, no matter what decision you make, there are risks involved. You can't avoid risk in life, all right? But if people are unwilling to take risks because they don't know what to expect in the future, then this slows down economic activity. Well, hyperinflation is very high rates of inflation, like Argentina's experienced. It's just definition. What is an example of hyperinflation? In 1923, the German mark, now back then Germany dealt in marks, you know, that was way before the euro. In 1923, the German mark inflated from 2,000 to the dollar to 4,200,000,000,000 to the dollar in 1 year. I mean, during this time in the early 20s, you'd see pictures of people going into grocery stores with whole wheelbarrows full of money and walking out with a loaf of bread. Now, what can cause that kind of inflation? The increase in money supply more than you increase goods and services. Okay. And can this happen again? See, eventually quantitative easing is going to cause inflation. Okay? And it's also going to cause unemployment. See, that's why one of the chapters coming up is called stagflation. You know, like we experienced in the 70s. Prices were increasing the same time we had growing unemployment. And quantitative easing can bring about another period of stagflation. The economy can be inflating because of the money supply increasing so much, but we could at the same time experience high rates of unemployment.
Is that a real number? $4 trillion, $200 billion?
Yeah, that's an actual number. And this has happened in other countries.
That's not just an example?
No.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. And other countries have experienced, you know, high rates of inflation. Zimbabwe here recently has experienced very high rates of inflation. But every time is for the same reason. The monetary authorities increase the money supply. That's what happened in Germany. See, what happened after World War I, at the Versailles Peace Treaty, is that the Allied powers thought that Germany ought to pay for all the war damage. And here Germany was almost, destroyed because of the war, their factories, etc. And their economy was in shambles. And yet the Allied powers are saying, well, you owe us so many billions of marks to pay for all this war damage, because it was your fault that, you know, that there was a war. You know, I'm talking about World War I. So where did Germany get the money to pay the Allied powers after World War I?
They made it.
They made it, yeah, right? They just crank, you make German marks off on a printing press and stuffed it into railroad cars and shipped it to France and shipped it to Spain. And I mean, you know, these countries were experiencing, you know, car full loads of German marks. And that's how Germany paid its debts. A country can do that. But as a result, what happened?
World War II.
Well, actually, yeah, that's... I want to get too much into the politics, but it definitely was a factor. You bet it was. But it led to hyperinflation in Germany, which destroyed the economy, which weakened the political system, which led to a vacuum which Adolf Hitler quickly filled. And that's where you get World War II.
Is that kind of what's going on right now down in Brazil with President?
Well, yeah, Brazil is on the verge of a big change. I don't think it's going to be violent, but it could be. Yeah, Brazil is on the verge of a revolution, whether it's military or peaceful, it's remains to be seen.
Did you see all those protests, like hundreds of thousands and millions of people walking down the country?
Protesting? Yeah, on YouTube. I'm not sure if I've seen that, but...
It's been in the news.
Yeah.
The last couple months.
There's this econ conference I went to, there was a well-known economist from Brazil, and he's going to translate this textbook into Portuguese so he can use it in Brazil. Because I said, well, you know, why are you here? I mean, you came to Alabama all the way from Brazil. And he said, the only thing that's available to him in Brazil is Marxist, you know, communist type literature and textbooks. He says it clearly doesn't work. And so I'm here to find out about Austrian economics, and because I know that works. Anyway, he took a copy of the book that you use, and he's translating it right now. Anyway, what is deflation? A sustained decrease in the price level. That's deflation. And disinflation, again, this is just vocabulary, means that there's a that we've had inflation, but the rates of inflation from one time period to the next is less and less and less. You know, like we have inflation of 20%, and then we got inflation the next year of 15%, and the next year of 10%. Well, we call that disinflation. Again, it's just vocabulary, that's all. Interest, the dollar amount paid to lenders to forego present consumption imposed to borrowers. Of course, you know, that's what interest is. Normally, you know, when banks lend out money, they charge interest. Of course, is that true all the time? What's happening in much of Europe? And what's going to happen in the United States? We've got negative interest rates. So instead of you put money in the bank and the bank paying you interest, when you put money in the bank, you've got to pay the bank to keep your money. That, you know, that's how negative interest rates work. And what do negative interest rates lead to? Well, people have got less incentive to put their money in banks, so they hoard their currency. And so what does the government do to prevent people from hoarding currency?
Limit the amount
they can take out. Yeah, well, limit the amount and take out of circulation, high denomination bills. Eventually, all currency. See, if we eliminated currency, like if we eliminated the dollar and people could only buy and sell through their bank account, then could people hoard their money? You know, could they put money, dollar bills in their mattress?
Start now.
Yeah. Well, but that dollar bills won't have any value. They'll make illegal dollar bills. They'll say the only way that you can buy and sell is through your bank account. And then people have lost all their freedom. Because if they disagree with the government, what can the government do at that point? Just delete their bank account, and they can't buy or sell. So it's all a matter of control. But that's the future. Yeah.
If inflation is just an increase to the money supply, can't you just take dollar bills out of circulation to stop it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It should be sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Is that what they,
it's a show in reverse. But now remember, most of our money supply. I mean, what you say is true, regardless of what I'm going to say now. But most of our money is not physical. I don't know how much, I'd only be guessing, but maybe 95% of our money is just digital. It's just zeros and ones on a computer. So you take money, but you can still take money out of circulation digitally, just as you could physically. And yeah, that would be, the whole thing would be thrown in reverse. Yeah.
I never understood coin collections.
Well, it's value. I mean, anything is, you know, like paintings, you know. Value, you know, value of anything is what, like if you own a house, what's the value of your house? The value of your house is whatever someone's willing to pay for it, right? Same with coins, you know. I mean, if you collect coins, what's the value? Well, if someone's willing to pay you X amount of money, that's the value. And certain things have, value. But people put value on things. They don't have value intrinsically. Yeah? What?
You said
it. I said it? Yeah. And the interest rate, of course, would be a percentage that one would be charged to pay, like 10% interest. And I've talked to you about before, you know, that like with credit cards, interest is calculated, it depends on the credit card, but it could be calculated daily or even by the minute or even by the second. And how do you calculate interest, like on a mortgage? If you, let's say you borrow $100,000 and you pay 10% interest, what's your interest payment the first month? Anybody? So you borrow $100,000. The interest rate's 10%. Now, I'm not saying your payment. I'm saying your interest payment. I'm, you know, not your total payment. I don't know what your total payment's going to be, but I do know to the penny what your interest payment will be. Well, you go 10% times 100,000 is 10,000, divided by 12 because this you're paying it on a monthly basis. And that's your interest payment. Okay? And now, if you pay, let's say, $100, toward your principal, what is your interest payment the second month? Well, the second month, you don't owe $100,000, right? You owe $100,000 minus $100. So whatever that is, you go 10% times that amount divided by 12, and that's your interest payment the second month. And that's the way you do. If you have a 30-year mortgage, that's the way your interest payment is calculated month after month after month. Now, how much you pay depends on the length of the loan. You know, if you take out a 15-year mortgage as opposed to a 30-year mortgage, your payment will be higher, which simply means the interest that you pay is the same. But with a 15-year mortgage, you're paying more toward the principal every month. You know, you're paying above and beyond your interest, the amount of interest you owe, more than you would with a 30-year loan. But the interest that you pay doesn't change. Okay, your balance will change. You know, there's a big difference.
So it's cost effective for you to pay early.
Yes, and that's a good point. And that's true with mortgages, it's true with credit cards. If you know, the more you pay, then these calculations, you know, your principal is going down, and so you in my personal finance course, I actually have you can avail yourself to these slides, by the way, and my personal finance course has a website that's connected to your website. I have a whole series of PowerPoint slides that actually show you mathematically how much you can save if you make extra payments, like on a mortgage or on a credit card. That's a good point. How are savers affected by inflation? Well, I've already talked about this, savers versus creditors. The nominal interest is, the word nominal means this is the dollar figure, as opposed to the real interest. Like if you borrow money, let's say you pay 10%, that's the nominal interest. But if inflation's 10%, then your real interest is actually zero. So, you know, the real, every time you see the word real in front of something, that means, well, this has been adjusted for inflation, where nominal means that we haven't adjusted it for inflation. It's just a dollar amount. And what is the real rate of interest? The interest rate expressed in dollars of constant purchasing power as a percentage of the amount loaned. In other words, I've explained this to you, the effect that inflation has on the real rate of interest. How do we measure the real rate of interest? The nominal rate of interest minus the inflation rate. Okay, again, you know, we've adjusted for inflation when you see the word real. What does higher inflation, why does higher inflation cause higher interest rates? Well, that's pretty simple, right? I mean, if you're a lender and you say I want to make a real return of 10% on my loan, if inflation's 10%, well, you haven't made anything. So what do you got to do in order to make a real 10% return? You have to charge 20% interest. So the higher the inflation is, then in order for lenders to make a real return on when they lend money out, they've got to increase the interest rate greater than the inflation rate in order to make a real return on the amount of money paid back to them. Also, the Federal Reserve may raise interest rates. See, now, what does the Federal Reserve have to do with interest rates? There's only two interest rates that the Federal Reserve actually controls, the discount rate and the federal funds rate. But all other interest rates are determined by market forces. But how does the Federal Reserve influence those interest rates? They influence those interest rates by influencing the money supply. Okay? If the money supply increases, then interest rates come down. If the money supply decreases, interest rates go up. But the Federal Reserve doesn't have absolute control over the money supply. You know, they can do this and they can do that, but that doesn't mean that that money is actually going to either be taken out or get into the economy, you know, like in the United States economy. You know, that's what's happening now, right? Because of quantitative easing, we've created a bunch of new money, but most of the money's not gotten into our system. It's gotten off into that parallel universe that I talked about. How are investors affected by inflation? Because investors make decisions based on expectations, unanticipated inflation leads to uncertainty and a decline in investments. I've already talked about this. What fiscal policies would be used to bring down inflation? We could cut government spending, raise taxes, relax trade restrictions, increase productivity. It would be the best thing to do. What fiscal policies? Now, notice the word fiscal here. You know, they're monetary and fiscal policies. Policies of the Federal Reserve are called monetary policies. But these are fiscal policies, policies of the federal government. These are things the federal government can do to influence the price level. And I think we're at the end here. And how to protect yourself from high rates of inflation? Well, you put your money, like that video we saw about Argentina, you know, people had incentive to put their money in something that's going to retain value more than their currency. Like it could be real estate or it could be art. Or it could be what you mentioned, coins, you know. It could be gold or silver. Anything that's going to retain its value more than the physical currency.
Why is it I can buy a loaf of bread for like a dollar? I don't know, is it maybe it's an overseas thing or something, but like on Monday and then on Friday, it's like $1.75, but they say, oh, we charge a dollar, it's just the daily tax. Why is...
Well, I mean, retail store owners can charge anything they want, and there's lots of things that'll affect the prices. I mean, it just depends on the situation. You know, supply is a big deal to do with it. You know, supply decreases, the price will go up. If it increases, it'll go down. Demand, it's supply and or demand. But exactly what it is depends on the situation. So, any questions about inflation or anything at all? So I did get through the chapter, didn't I? Let's call it a day. And now remember, Thursday I'll be at this conference. So I'll see you a week from today.